Kneeling here, I feel good. A poem by Marge Piercy. Sand, crystalline children of dead mountains, little quartz worlds rubbed by the wind. Compost, rich as memory, sediment of our pleasures, orange rinds and roses and beef bones, coffee and cork and dead lettuce, trimmings of hair and lawn. I marry you, I marry you. In your mingling under my grubby nails, I touch the seeds of what will be. Revolution and germination are mysteries of birth, without which many are born to starve. I am kneeling and planting. I am making fertile. I am putting some of myself back in the soil. Soon enough, sweet black mother of our food, you will have rest.
Evening, everybody. Thanks for coming. This is really exciting to see so many people here. I'm so grateful. Thanks, David, for reading that poem. Thank you also to the Creation Care Council and the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding, Department of Applied Social Services, College of Bible and Religion, and Deirdre Smeltzer and Rhonda Rittenhouse and everybody at the Undergraduate Dean's Office for making this possible. This is really, really exciting. My name is Jonathan McRae, and I'm the Sustainability Curriculum Coordinator here at EMU, which means I help connect students to efforts in sustainability and social justice in the community. Aside from that, I'm also one of those people who, as James Baldwin said, who believe that they were white. People like me were a lot of things before becoming white: Irish, English, German, Italian, Mennonite. Becoming white, Baldwin said, took this country generations and a vast amount of coercion. And people like me continually whitewash ourselves when we tell history only from above, or when we assume that our experiences are normative, when we believe poverty is due to laziness, when we believe some people are predisposed to crime, when we trust authority because it has badges, or when we only defend unborn life but never black and brown lives. If we want safety or freedom, those of us who think we're white need to learn to be something else again. For as Baldwin reminds us, there are no white people. There's only a moral choice to be silent or to struggle. Because whiteness isn't really about pigment. It's about a type of power. With a very, very different type of power and a very beautiful type of power, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote, "Like a boil that can never be cured so long as it is covered up, but must be open with all its ugliness to the natural medicines of air and light, injustice must be exposed with all the tension its exposure creates to the light of human conscience and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. If we will wake up to see these national boils are exposed in their full ugliness right now, and some of the most medicinal work I know about happens at Soulfire Farm in the little town of Grafton, New York." I first learned about Soulfire a couple years ago through a Yes Magazine article about radical farmers using fresh food to fight racial injustice and the new Jim Crow. I read about this family farm that was cross-pollinating restorative justice, agroecology, emotional and spiritual activism, and the movement for black lives. If we are to create a society that values black life, the article proclaimed, we cannot ignore the role of land and food, because this work is not separate. The work is woven. There's a liberation theologian named James Cone who once said that the cross and the lynching tree are the same species. Also said this: the logic that led to slavery and segregation in the Americas, colonization and apartheid in Africa, and the rule of white supremacy throughout the world is the same one that leads to the exploitation of animals and the ravaging of nature. People who fight against white racism but fail to connect it to the degradation of the earth are anti-ecological, whether they know it or not. people who struggle against environmental degradation but do not incorporate in it a disciplined and sustained fight against white supremacy are racist, whether they know it or not. The fight for justice cannot be segregated, but must be integrated with the fight for life in all its forms. Our guest tonight, Leah Penniman, who wrote that Yes Magazine article and co-founded Soulfire Farm, sees these logical fallacies. Leah is an educator, a farmer, a food justice activist committed to dismantling the oppressive structures that misguide our food system, to reconnecting marginalized communities to land, and to upholding our responsibility to steward the land that nourishes us. She fights for life in all its forms with the natural medicines of air and light. As a high school science teacher, spiritual activist, and uprooting racism facilitator, Leah joyfully and reverently connects learners to the intricate miracle that is this living planet and to their own power as agents of positive change in the community. Leah holds an MA in science education and BA in environmental science and international development. She's been farming since 96 and taught since 2002. Her work as a farmer and educator has been recognized nationally by the Fulbright Distinguished Awards in Teaching Program, Presidential Award for Science Teaching, Food First, National Science Teachers Association, and many, many others. When I first met Leah, I was greeted by conviction and by grace, a rooted presence that also flies from a silk trapeze in their rafters. Her spirituality and vocation stem from reverence for the earth and her people. Leah lives at Soulfire Farm with her animating and compassionate husband, Jonah, their deep and artful children, Nishima and Emmett, and their kin creatures of field and forest. So please welcome Leah Penniman.
Okay, so he said everything, so we're good. No, thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be in the company of other spiritual activists. So often when I organize with folks, we can only connect on the material. You know, we can connect around the statistics, around the injustice, around the exploitation of earth in quantitative terms and come up with action plans. And it is such a blessing to be amongst people who see that the sacred is interconnected with the physical. So I'm very, very happy to be here. And thanks. I know it took a lot of work and coordination to get here. But we are going to start, before we do anything, with looking backwards, because we don't know where we come. We don't know where we are if we don't know where we come from. And I want to tell a story of an ancestor of mine. She's my grandma's grandma's grandma. Her name is Susie Boyd. That's her slave name. And when people in her community in the Dahomey region of West Africa, the Gold Coast, were being kidnapped and taken to unknown futures, remember there was no report backs, right? What the women in the community did as insurance was to take the seed that they had preserved for generations, the okra seed, the rice seed, the millet, the sorghum, and to braid it into their hair and into their children's hair, so that wherever they were going, they would be able to put that genetic destiny into soil, and they trusted in a harvest. That was their hope in the face of despair. And I call that image into being because right now, we're in times when the empire is emboldened, when the injustices that all of us knew had always been there are laid bare and apparent, and it can be discouraging. And I have to remember that if my grandma's grandma's grandma could witness the kidnapping of her sisters and her children and make the decision to put seeds in her hair, then I have no right to give up. And so I invite you in this moment to think of an ancestor who sacrificed for you, a blood ancestor who sacrificed for you. And I'm going to count to three, and we are going to say their names in gratitude and bring them into the space. One, two, three. Toussaint Louverture, Ashe. So Gandhi said, if we forget how to dig the earth and how to tend and till the soil, we forget ourselves. And I believe in this spiritual connection to land. And I also know that many of my people, black and brown people, mixed people, have lost that connection, not because of any decision we made or any spiritual inadequacy, but because of a long legacy of injustice in the food system. And I would argue that the fact that some people have enough food to eat and some people have nothing or only foods that bring life-threatening disease, that some people have land and others do not, was not an accident of history, that it was actually baked into the food system itself. So before I talk about our work and all the ways we can fix all the problems, we must contextualize it in the legacy. So here's an image. Does anyone know what this image represents? Yes. What is the manifest destiny?
We can do what we want.
What specifically? And who's we?
The empowered ones can kill or seize whatever they want.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Can anyone add to that? That's excellent. So manifest destiny is a philosophy that European people have the God-given right to seize and colonize and inhabit all of the land of this continent from sea to shining sea. And it was national policy, and it has not been erased, obviously. What do you see retreating in the wake of Lady Manifest Destiny? First Nations people. Who else is retreating? The buffalo, nature. So exactly what Jonathan was saying about how we cannot separate the imperative for racial justice and the imperative for ecological justice. So right from the beginning, you know, all of the land which grows all of the food we eat is stolen land, all the billions of acres. And we get to this next phase of history where there's a necessity to labor the land in order to produce the food. There's stolen land and there's a necessity for labor. And how did European colonizers satisfy that labor need? What is this image? Mm-hmm. The transatlantic slave trade, right? Millions of African people were kidnapped from the shores of West Africa, but came from all across the continent. Contrary to popular mythology, these were not people who were just sheer laborers, unskilled folks who were kind of randomly snatched. European people did not know how to do tropical and subtropical agriculture. They needed experts to teach them and to lead. And so people, slave catchers, would target the expert agriculturalist of the Gold Coast, of the Congo, of the Yoruba and Igbo regions, who established rice farming in the Carolinas, which became hugely lucrative, and the herding of Cuba, which became hugely lucrative, and the sugar plantations. So our ancestors were kidnapped and provided the labor. So right from the basis, and many people know this, this is basic history, right, that we have stolen land and stolen labor. But what becomes confusing is we're sort of told, well then, you know, Emancipation Proclamation, whatever, and then it's over. You know, then it was like a fair playing field, and now if there's any injustices, that's just because people aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. But we need to look a little bit deeper. So this is right after 1865. Does anyone know what happened in 1865 in this country that's significant to African American people and by extension all of us? Anybody? Mm-hmm. The Civil War is over. What was added to the Constitution after the Civil War? 13th, yes. So the 13th Amendment, which outlawed slavery, right? But there's an exception clause. If you don't believe me, you can actually look on your smartphone right now and read the 13th Amendment. It says that slavery is abolished except in the case of if you were convicted of a crime, right? And so what happened is, right after 1865, there was a huge fear of a labor vacuum. There was a huge fear by white Southerners of black folks getting uppity, competing. And of course, rich whites would exploit this fear and try to pit poor rural white folks against black folks to try to exacerbate those racial tensions. They feared class uprising. And so what they did was establish something called the Black Codes. So the Black Codes were the law of the land in the South. It's the first time things like vagrancy and loitering became illegal. Those are other ways of saying hanging around and not having a job gets you in jail. But the thing with the Black Codes was, if you were a Black person and you congregated in a group of two or more, or you congregated at a railroad, or you didn't have a job and you needed your letter from your former employer, who was the slave master, to get a job, then you were guilty of a crime and you could go to jail. So in 1864, 95% of the prison population in the South was white. In 1866, it reversed, and 95% was Black. And it's not because Black people went on some kind of killing rampage, raping people. That did not happen. It was loitering. It was vagrancy. It was being accused of crimes and then being convicted by an all-white jury. He stole my hog. You know, Mr. Jones said he stole my hog, and so you're in jail. And the reason that this happened was to fill the labor vacuum. The state established a convict leasing program. So the state had temporary custody of these Black bodies and leased them out to private individuals and corporations in the coal mines, the railroads, and the plantations. The mortality rate in the coal mines was 25% within a one-year sentence, because there was no incentive to actually keep our ancestors alive. They were rented. From there, we had sharecropping, we had tenant farming, we had slavery by another name. So that DNA of our food system continued to be reinforced on stolen land and stolen labor. This is 1935. Does anyone know what happened then? After the Great Depression, huge piece of federal legislation. Yep, the New Deal, which included some very important provisions for workers. Anyone know what those were? It's okay, I forgot everything about history too. I had to look all this stuff up again, but it actually is relevant because these laws haven't changed very much. So this is Social Security was established, right? Getting cared for in your old age, health insurance in your old age. And at first, when this law was drafted, every single American worker was included. And there was such pushback from the legislators in the South that they changed the law to exclude two sectors. Can you guess what two sectors were excluded from Social Security? Yeah, domestic workers and agricultural workers. They were also excluded from the Fair Labor Standards Act and the National Labor Relations Act, which established minimum wage, the right to collective bargaining, overtime pay, fair and safe working conditions, outlawing child labor. Those two sectors were excluded and continue to be excluded, not from Social Security, but from many of the provisions of the National Labor Relations Act and Fair Labor Standards Act. So even to this day, you have a different minimum wage, you have no right to overtime, you have no right to collectively bargain if you are a farm worker or a domestic worker or you work in the food service. So it hasn't fundamentally changed. And if you look up the campaigns of La Cosecha or Farm Workers Alliance, you can see that people are fighting and struggling just to have the same rights that every other worker has in the food system. So we go forward another decade, and the Great Migration is taking place. African American people are moving, 6.5 million of us from the rural South to the paved streets of the industrialized North, seeking an escape from the Jim Crow realities. And there's a labor vacuum again. And you would think the US by now would be like, you know what? It's time to start actually paying the real cost of food. You know, we're gonna like rethink this whole thing. But that's not actually what happened. Does anyone know what program started in the 40s? Bracero program, now called the H-2, people get H-2 visas. About 200,000 guest workers come to the United States and do the jobs that a lot of US citizens don't want to do, including meatpacking and things, you know, around here. And while there are some standards that are supposed to protect these workers, because people come in contracted to a particular employer and they can't move freely in the labor market, if they complain and have a problem with their boss, they're simply deported. So there's a huge disincentive to have these laws enforced. And there's rampant documentation of sexual abuse, physical abuse, wage theft, and other types of problems with this program. And to this day, 75% of our food is grown by guest workers. So at the same time that this was happening, Dr. King speaks to something that was happening in the Black farming community in the South. So we're just going to hear right from him. If I can get, thank you.
At the same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Mm-hmm. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
Our check. So what Dr. King is talking about, he's really summarizing what the 1985 Commission on Civil Rights uncovered, because black farmers were losing their lands at steady and unprecedented rates. We went from having 16 million acres of land in 1910, and that wasn't because of 40 acres and a mule. That never happened. That was a false promise. But because of people saving up their Sunday money from tenant farming and gathering up so much land that we were 14% of the farm managing population at the turn of the century. And it was less than 1% in the 80s and continues to be. So a Civil Rights Commission looked into it and found that the federal government, namely the USDA, was the driving force of black land loss through systemic discrimination against the boll farmer. So there would be the cotton boll weevil epidemic, and there would be loans and relief for white farmers and nothing for black farmers. There would be land-grant universities that would exclude black farmers. There would be giveaways of land to white farmers and not to black farmers. And over the decades, there was an erosion of the economic viability. And to this day, and I'll say one other thing about that. So especially the height of this was during the 1960s with the Civil Rights Movement, when literally if you signed a petition, registered to vote, joined the NAACP, you would be denied access to loans or support. And this is well documented. Pete Daniel did some work in Dispossession. PBS did some work in Homecoming. And if there was a lawsuit in 1999, Pigford versus Glickman, it was a class action lawsuit on behalf of 50,000 black farmers, and they won. But at this point, these farmers are 80, 90 years old. The average settlement payout was $50,000. And if anyone knows anything about land and farming, you can barely get a piece of equipment. So the land, it didn't fundamentally rectify the situation, even though it was a moral reconciliation acknowledgement. This was the last agricultural census, little infographic I made, so you can see that the racial division in terms of who owns our rural land is stark, and it's actually more divided than it's been in the last century in terms of amassing wealth and resource in the hands of one racial group. Also in the last agricultural census, or Department of Labor, census, farming was ranked as the whitest profession. And we're not talking about farm workers, because they're not even counted, actually, in the census, if you can believe it. We're talking about primary, secondary, and tertiary farm managers, who are the only people who are counted. Used to be the most multiracial and diverse profession. And in terms of people who are working in the food system, the types of working conditions and wages and benefits people receive are also divided along race lines. We all know that food sector work is not paid very well at all. Anyone who's ever, worked at a restaurant or worked on a farm, you know that. But even within that sector, if you are a person of color, you are likely to earn a lower wage than a white person across all aspects of the food system. Any idea where this young lady is? This beautiful girl? That's not me, no. It's not me. Any idea where she is? Yeah, she's at a food pantry. She's gathering up food that she's going to take home and nourish herself and her siblings. And I put that picture up because even if you look at the consumer ends of the food system, not just the producers who has access to land, but how much food we get, we are in a nation, a wealthy nation, where we still have 16 million children who are going to go to bed hungry tonight. And that's 1 in 6 white children, and that's 1 in 3 black children, 1 in 4 Latino children. So the house is on fire, but not all the rooms are burning at the same rate. I know you can't see these numbers very well, but when we don't have access to food, it also means we don't have access to health. So there are many, many people in this country who live in what's called a food desert or food apartheid neighborhood, where the only things they can get are these empty calories. You can get soda and chips if you have a few dollars in your pocket. You can get hot Cheetos and Takis, but you can't get an orange, you can't get a salad, you can't get any of the things that are really gonna nourish and give you life. So the rates of diabetes, heart disease, obesity, depression in Black and brown communities is much higher than they are in white communities because of this lack of access. So there's a lot of issues. And like I said, I was feeling, at times I feel overwhelmed and discouraged. I call on my ancestors for strength. I call on nature. I call on the divine for strength. But I knew, and this is a teaching in the Talmud also, and our family has Jewish heritage, is that you are not obligated to complete a task, right? Says Perkei Avot. But you are obligated to take a step in that direction. And we knew that if we didn't do something, then we were actually casting our vote of complicity in favor of the status quo. So we had to ask ourselves, as farmers, as food justice workers, in what ways are we complicit with this story? In what ways are we a change agent? And we looked at these sort of four issues in the food system that we could potentially address. People need food, healthy, culturally appropriate, affordable food. Food producers need dignified working conditions. We can't trash the earth while we're growing food, right? We need ecologically sound methods, and everyone deserves a voice. And we asked ourselves, how can I be a change agent? How am I complicit? So before I kind of tell you what we came up with and the story of Soulfire Farm, I would love you to turn to someone next to you and ask each other those questions. In what way are you complicit with a broken food system, either through ignorance, inaction, inability to act? In what ways are you already a change agent trying to make a difference? So I'm going to give you a minute. Really talk to somebody. Well, thank you. We're going to keep this conversation moving, but it's something, a lens I'd love you to have in mind as we go through. My story is going to be different from your story about how I choose to act, but we all are obligated to take a step toward justice. So at Soulfire, we really believe that to get free, we need to be part of feeding ourselves, that personal food sovereignty is integral to our liberation as people. And there are five basic ways that we go about it. So first, can you guys read that okay? All right, this is gonna be the most wordy slide. I know it breaks the seven like lines per slide rule, but we're so mission oriented, and I feel like the mission is something we come back to all the time to ask ourselves, are we doing the right thing in this moment? Does it align? Then I'm actually gonna read this to you, but I'm gonna need your participation. So as I read it, if there is a word or phrase that resonates with you, I need you to say it with me at the same time with conviction. So like if I were gonna say love and you're into love, then you would say?
Love.
Exactly. Okay, here we go. Ready? Soulfire Farm is committed to ending racism and injustice in the food system. We raise life-giving food. I actually can't read this, Molly. And act in solidarity with people marginalized by food apartheid. With deep reverence for the lands and wisdom of our ancestors, we work to reclaim our collective right to belong to the earth and to have agency in the food system. We bring together diverse communities on this healing lands to share skills on sustainable agriculture, natural building, spiritual activism, health, and environmental justice. We are training the next generation of activist farmers and strengthening the movements for food sovereignty and community self-determination. Ashe, that was nice. Good job, you guys. So if something resonated with you, what was it and why? What was a word that you felt you need to call out?
Sustainable agriculture.
And why did sustainable agriculture speak to you?
Mm-hmm.
Ashe, definitely. Oh, Ashe means so be it or life force and Yoruba. So if you hear me saying that, it's kind of like an African amen. What else? What else resonated with you? Yes.
Sovereignty.
Why sovereignty?
Because for me, with that word, I associate it with ownership specifically, ownership and agency specifically without colonialism.
Mm-hmm. She was saying ownership and agency without colonialism. Are there any words here that you don't know what they mean and you want me to explain? Sure. So natural building is creating dwelling spaces and structures for human beings that are in conversation with the natural environment. It's different from green building, because you can have a LEED certified green building that you sort of plop down and is not in conversation with the natural landscape. So where we live, our building materials and resources are our clay soils, our pine trees, and our straw. So we build our buildings out of pine trees and clay and straw, and they face the south because it's cold, and the walls are 18 inches thick because it's cold, and we use big stones around our wood stove to as thermal mass to pull that heat in and radiate it slowly so that we only have to burn a cord of wood a year and don't have to decimate the forest. So natural building is about thinking about how can we have the minimal impact on this landscape and still meet human needs for safety and comfort. Great question. Any other terms?
Food yes. Apartheid.
Food apartheid. I have to credit my mentor, Karen Washington, who's an amazing black farmer from the Bronx, because I was saying food desert, which is the government term for an area where you just can't get good food and where a lot of people are low income. And she was like, a desert is a naturally created biome. It's a phenomenon that belongs here, that emerged through a geological process. Apartheid is a human-created system of segregation that we need to uproot. And that's what we have in the food system. We don't have an accident, right? We have a human-created system of segregation. Any other terms? Okay, well, if you think of any, just interrupt me. We can flow with this. Okay, so remember, we do five things to fix it. The first one is straight up feeding our people without destroying the land. So I was living in the south end of Albany, which is a food apartheid neighborhood. I have a master's degree, and I've been farming, and I could not get any food for my newborn and my two-year-old. It was devastating. There was no grocery store. There was no farmer's market. There was no community garden plot. I asked my neighbors who had land. They didn't want to share. So I literally joined a farm share CSA program and walked 2.5 miles with my two-year-old in the stroller and the baby in the backpack to go pick up the food, which was half of our income, and walk back down the hill with the vegetables on top of the two-year-old. And she was very tolerant. You know, she's kind of chill, right? You know my daughter. But that was what it took to get vegetables in that neighborhood. And that's not an uncommon story. And so we said, let's start a farm. Well, actually, our neighbor said, you all need to start a farm for us and get the food right to the doorsteps of people who live there. So we created what's called the Ujamaa Farm Share. Ujamaa is a Kiswahili word that means cooperative economics. It is about moving beyond the capitalist transactional relationship between producer and consumer toward a relational economic connection. So when you join our Ujamaa Farm Share, which we affectionately call Netflix for vegetables, because it's a subscription program, we promise to give you the highest quality food every week from June to November, right to your doorstep at whatever price you can afford, and will not cut you off if you cannot pay. It will be a full, beautiful box with all the vitamins and minerals your family needs. And you promise to stay with us. Every week, we're going to have this interaction. And so we fed thousands of people. We do 80 to 100 families per year. This year, we're focusing especially on refugees and immigrants who are being targeted by state violence right now and are often in hiding in their communities. So we're using kind of our above-ground railroad networks to identify these families and get food to them through the church community. In growing this food, we can't trash the planet, right? So we came to, the only reason we could afford this property was because it was very degraded land. It's about $2,000 an acre, whereas right across, you know, the border in Massachusetts, you're paying $10,000 to $20,000 an acre of land. And all the farmers around us are like, you can't grow food. Then the USDA classifies soils into 13 categories. Ours was 13th for the poorest soil, which means we don't get any tax breaks. But we were like, we can do it. I mean, we had been farming in the city with lead levels of 11,000 parts per million, where children were getting lead poisoning from playing on playgrounds. So we knew how to fix soil. And we said, let's just take those same principles and bring this land back to health. So we literally moved soil that had eroded down the mountainside. We literally wheelbarrowed it back up. We planted cover crops and mulch. We brought in beneficial insects. We inoculated with fungi. It took us 4 years. And we had finally had enough topsoil to grow vegetables. And every year we sequester more carbon and build more topsoil and bring in more pollinators. Because we believe that it's our responsibility to actually leave the earth better, right, than we found it. Natural building, I mentioned. This is a timber frame, straw bale construction in process. We do what's called cluster development. So there's 68 acres relatively untouched for the wildlife, and only about 5 acres that we're actively managing. So that was the first thing, was to feed our community. The second thing was a little bit trickier, right? Because food access, like, everyone can get down with that, like feed the hungry. It can still smell a little bit like paternalism, but we're like, how do we really deal with the fact that our people were robbed of $6.4 trillion of value of our labor, that we don't have our land anymore? You know, I'm not in a place to demand reparations of the entire nation. So we had to ask ourselves, what can we do from where we're at? And time and again, when we were talking to our elders from the South, they were quoting Malcolm X. And they were saying, actually, without land and a connection to land, we don't have our freedom, we don't have justice, we don't have equality. And we decided that what we could do is provide a culturally relevant training program to help aspiring Black and Brown farmers gain access to land and have the skills to manage that land. Because people were telling us that when they tried to access conventional, you know, organic, but still like white space kind of training programs, at best it was culturally irrelevant, and at worst they experienced outright discrimination, denial from programs, denial of access to incubator farm status. And when I put one Facebook post out, I said, we are going to have a Black and Brown led farmer training for 20 people. It filled up in less than an hour. So I added another one, it filled up in less than an hour. We took 100 people this year for our Black and Latinx farmers immersion. We had to turn away 200. Our people want to farm. We want to go back to the land. There is no other training program in the nation that is a rural commercial farm that is led by people who look like the people who want to learn. So it's something now we're doing a train the trainer. We're trying to get these programs to expand because people really need the skills, yes. So we do cation exchange capacity and we learn how to put on the bucket loader, but we also need to delve into our histories and we need to heal from the trauma that comes from 500 years of land-based oppression. There's a way that our people have confused the harm that happened on land with the land herself. And until we actually deal with that healing, we can't move forward and reclaim our rightful place of agency on the earth. We've had over 300 graduates of our program. Almost everyone is farming, urban gardening, or doing food justice activism. I was just at a Just Food conference in New York City, and it was like, we get to see our graduates just all up in the space. It was so beautiful. Do you have a question?
Yeah. Why were the people excluded from what you were calling the other programs, the other training programs? Why were they excluded?
Why were they excluded? I mean, the short answer is, I would say, implicit bias, which is a form of racism where white people aren't aware of the way that they're exercising power and privilege to exclude those who don't feel comfortable around or who don't have credentials that look like what they're familiar with. I would say that's the overall reason, but each person has a specific story. Yeah.
But it was couched in legitimacy all the time?
Was it couched in legitimacy all the time? Here's an example. So one young man who came to our program, he started out doing the woofing program, that volunteer willing workers on organic farms. He gets to this one farm and he's picking beans with the white farm owner. He's a Black man. And he says, the owner says, can I ask you something? He said, sure. He said, why is it that Black men always leave their families behind? And the Black man said, I don't actually appreciate that question. I think that's a racist question. So he was kicked out of the program. That's one example. So was that overt? You decide. Well, on the healing tip, and this is where I think we all connect, because I thought the spiritual stuff was like an accidental side product. But everybody we would do all this like amazing, nerdy learning about interpreting like the pH and how it influences aluminum uptake and blah, 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 blah. And then we would sing and we would dance under the moon and, you know, just like get down with ourselves. And people would be like, giving up addictions, leaving abusive relationships, making decisions to kind of fully inhabit, find their voice, if they were a singer to decide to sing. Like all of this powerful, profound personal work was happening in addition to the farming. And we realized that actually they weren't two separate stories. Just like racial justice and ecological justice are not different, spiritual wholeness can't be separated from this kind of liberatory learning and reclamation of our place. So what I handed out to you, hopefully many of you have a piece of paper. This was the end of our last Black and Latinx farmers immersion. We just asked people to write down, what is your experience? So we're gonna go around and read these. Give you guys a mic. Check, check. Okay. Who's the farthest back person who has one? Raise your hand if you have a paper. Okay, so we'll start here. And then just hand it and we'll go like this.
I am ready to spread the seeds of this experience back in my community.
We can't feed ourselves until we can... we can't feed ourselves until we can feed ourselves. All revolution is based on land.
If I can be free here, why can't I be free out there?
Being on this land is not the vacation from your life. It's like going to the mountaintop and coming down with the tablets.
I grew up around a lot of violence. I lost a lot of friends. When there were drive-by shootings, I would get low to the ground and smell the smell of the earth meant I was safe.
Like our ancestral mothers who hid rice grains and hope in their baby's hair as they boarded transatlantic slave ships.
If my resilience was a cup, it would be overflowing. We are doing the same damn thing, so ancient and futuristic at the same time. Love dripping over my whole being.
When we garden or orchard, it's because we can imagine a future. We believe we will be here to feed each other.
I looked up from weeding to see a field full of black and brown bodies bent over the land with me. I realized that the only images I have been fed of our bodies on land are images of trauma, oppression, and shame. I now understand that's not the whole story. There's always been more than that. Being here on the land together by choice, this is good.
We are thriving, not just surviving, allowed to be vulnerable and caring.
Our ancestral connection is deepened.
You are all mad sexy, soul fire sexy.
I am not going to settle for anything.
I can't go back to the bullshit. I can't go back to not being my unique self. I can't go back to eating shitty. I can't go back to not engaging all of my talents.
It is necessary to follow our calling. Barefoot, squatting, lowering myself down, touching the earth.
I don't ever have to feel alone. We got you. You are not alone.
This is reality. This is life.
This is big and eternal. We are going to win.
I reject the notion that I have to temper any part of who I am.
I have a love hangover. You believed in me.
All feel ignited, what we know to be true, love, abundance, oneness.
This is a familiar feeling at the soul level. I know you. I have seen you before.
Another world is possible.
This is mad cosmic and most spiritual. Damn, there are no words.
You have affirmed my capacity to dream, to see what it would look, feel, taste, smell like to live fully.
Here is love. I am love. I deserve it.
I want to cry because it feels so damn good to be alive in this moment. This is what it would feel like if we were free. Beneath the full moon, indigenous brown bodies reclaim peace and affirm that our lives matter.
Invited to commune with parts of ourselves we have been cut off from and didn't even know. This was an awakening of our sovereignty.
You trust me with my heart, my deepest parts. I am overflowing with hope. Freedom is not a lofty goal.
I feel a renewed commitment in my relationship to land. My spirit is brighter, bolder, and free.
I was about to quit farming, and I feel renewed. I got to experience for the first time something I have done 100 times.
This whole experience is a prayer, and an answer to prayer. I have never felt so consistently alive.
We are solid as a rock. We are rooted as a tree. We are here, standing strong in our rightful place.
Beautifully read. Beautifully read. I always think that you somehow end up with the statement that you need to, so keep that, and hopefully it resonates with you. So that was one and two, right? We got to feed our people and find a way to connect back to land, right? But then something really amazing happened as I was getting ready for Black and Latinx Farmers Immersion. Someone challenged me, and they were like, y'all are thinking too separately. It's like we go out into the field, and we learn about weeding and lasagna beds and whatever. And then we come inside, and we watch some documentary about Black land loss. But everything should be political, and everything should be ecological. And I was like, but how? Like, I don't see how they always connect. And what I realized was that I had bought into another mythology around sustainable agriculture. I actually thought that Elliot Coleman invented organic farming and like white guys from Hampshire invented permaculture. And it's just not actually true, because I went to all these farming conferences. I started farming when I was 16 years old, and I was having a serious identity crisis. I'm a mixed person, and like the white people I knew were into sustainable agriculture and like food forests and all this stuff, right? And the black people I knew wanted to stop gun violence and fix our urban schools, and they were like, which side are you on? And I was about to leave the land. I was like, I'm not, yeah. And every conference I went to, all the books from Chelsea Green Publishing were just like the Nearings and their disciples. And so I had to start doing my own research. And in fact, I'm writing the first book on this, which will come out in 2018, called Farming While Black. Because here's the thing, our people invented the most ubiquitous farming tool. You can laugh and be like, what is a hoe? But the hoe is the most versatile and widely used farming tool in the world. You can use it from everything from a wet rice paddy to a steep mountainside, a sandy or clay mountainside. Our people invented irrigation, the work party called combis or tequio, legume intercropping for nitrogen fixation, the use of mulches, the rotations of herding with grazing animals with cultivars for crops, rice technology, rice growing technology, beasts of burden, that all came out of Africa. Even right now, there's all of this supposedly new research about climate resilient agriculture and how we need to move away from a grain-based diet to a tuber and plantain-based diet because that has a higher yield and is more drought resistant. Blah, blah, blah. Those are the diets of sub-Saharan Africa that we're talking about. But it didn't stop on the continent. You guys all know Tuskegee Institute in Alabama is one of just the most brilliant group of agricultural minds that this country has known. Dr. George Washington Carver is famous for the peanut, but he was actually the first farmer in the United States to write about organic agriculture. He called it regenerative farming. He encouraged farmers to move away from cotton and tobacco monocropping and to develop diversified horticultures and to prioritize soil life above all else. And he did this through careful legume intercrops and paying a lot of attention to soil organic matter and moisture. Things that we're talking about now. One of his best students, ancestor Booker T. Watley, created the first CSA. He called it a clientele membership club. And he believed that if you had a loyal clientele that you could get to stick with your farm for an entire year and subscribe, then you could offer them wholesale prices. You could plan production and create almost zero waste on your farm, which would be more ecological. And he created also the first pick your own, because the people came and did the labor of picking the raspberries off of the plants and the grapes off of the plants, they would develop a relationship with the farm. He's not credited. The first land trust in the United States, the Sherrods. Shirley and Charles Sherrod went to Israel. They were inspired by kibbutzim. They said, how can we do this in the United States? They created the first community land trust, amassing almost 6,000 acres of land, which was co-owned by 500 black families in the deep South. Their white neighbors were so outraged. The governor launched a terror campaign on them. Their home was literally bombed. They were denied any access to credit when there was two straight years of drought, and they were driven off their land. They were the lead plaintiffs in the 1999 Pigford versus Glickman, and they won a $2 million settlement that they used to actually rebuild their farm. So now New Communities has a a new life. It has in just in the past couple of years. The cooperative movement, while it has many origins, we can't say it's only a Black origin, was really developed by the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, by the National Colored Farmers Alliance, and by Fannie Lou Hamer. She was really known for her work with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and she should be, she's amazing. But my friends who organized with her, my elders, they said they would go to her house for a meeting and all her shelves would be lined with canned food. And they'd be like, Mama Hamer, why do you spend all your time with your garden and things? She said, what are you gonna do when the supermarket closes? If you are relying on the system for your sustenance, you can't truly resist against the system because you actually want it to win. There's part of you that needs it to win and be in place. And so she was trying to get all of the activists to have their gardens and to can, and she started the Freedom Farm Cooperative. And with the sale of vegetables and hogs, she was able to fund scholarships, burial fees, shared equipment, and homes for 70 people. And it didn't stop there. These are some of the leaders of the food justice movement today. Does anyone know who any of these people are? Will Allen, yeah, what is he up to? Yeah, Growing Power, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He made urban farming economically viable and really put it on the map. A former basketball star, you know, going back to his farming roots. He's a tall guy with the blue. Anyone know anyone else? Yes, Tasha Bowens, good friends of mine. She's there with the ponytail in the book. She wrote Color of Food. She is a Philly area farmer, and she went all around the country documenting the story of Black, Latinx, First Nations, and Asian farmers who usually are excluded from conversations about American agriculture. Anyone else? Karen Washington, yep, here, I'll give these to you guys. Okay, so Karen Washington, I mentioned earlier because she coined the term food apartheid. She's at Rise and Root Farm in New York, but she's also the founder of the Black Urban Growers Network and Conference. Very important policy speaker and national organizer. She's a phenomenal person. Malik Yakini, Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. They run a 7-acre farm in downtown Detroit that's completely of, by, and for the Black community. They also have a food co-op, a food policy council, and youth corps. The Haitian peasant movement, I'm partial to because I'm Haitian on my mom's side. Any Caribbean folks in the house? Okay, it's just me. That's okay. That's all right. I forgive you. So the Haitian peasant movement actually won the Global Food Sovereignty Prize a couple years back for their resistance of Monsanto. So here's the thing. We're going to take a little philanthropy detour because this is something we have to think about in terms of like mercy and charity, because it feels really good and often is really good to take our resources and distribute them to people who need them. But it's not always that simple, right? So the U.S. has a policy in the Farm Bill called Tide Aid. And the law with Tide Aid is that anytime we give foreign food aid, or any aid actually, it needs to be produced by a U.S. corporation, packaged and shipped by a U.S. corporation. Sounds innocent enough, like, right, support U.S. domestic. So what happens, though, post-2010 earthquake in Haiti, it's the rice harvest season. Haiti was almost entirely food self-sufficient up until the 80s when the nonprofit industrial complex kind of took over the country, right? So it is the rice season, and the U.S. brings barges and barges and barges of free American rice to the coast as quote-unquote food relief. The president of Haiti tries to turn the ships around. He says, do not bring that rice to my nation. Why? Yeah, can you compete with free rice? If you're a peasant farmer and you're trying to grow your rice and it's rice harvest season, do you have like all these savings in the bank that you can just use to start over next year when you can't sell one grain of it? Hell no, right? The U.S., of course, because it actually is intentional to undermine economies of the global south and create them and put them in a dependency cycle, force that rice with guns onto the shore and gave it to the people of Haiti. Farmers continue to lose their, they lose their crop, they lose their income, they lose their land. They migrate to Port-au-Prince or to Port-au-Pay in the north, and they work for sweatshops making Disney t-shirts. So it drives this cycle of people off their land. So what the Haitian peasant movement is doing is they're trying to fight for their indigenous seed and their indigenous ways of growing, and they burned shipments of Monsanto seed. They stopped them at the port and they burned them, and they won the prize for that beautiful and courageous act, but also for the real organizing work that they're doing behind that, right? That's the display. But what they're actually doing, because I work with Haitian peasant farmers every year for the last decade or so, is that they are doing their own seed saving and seed exchanges. We have Dennis Derrick. Definitely check out Corbin Hill Food Project. He aggregates food from farmers all around New York State and feeds 80,000 families in the Bronx with a subsidized food share. He has a staff of 5 to accomplish that task. Bryant Terry is an incredible chef who's taken African Southern Black cuisine and Afro-Caribbean cuisine and remixed it with a local flair to debunk the myth that we have to like eat hummus and kale chips if we want to be healthy. Like, you can still eat your food, you know, and there's new ways to do it. And then Tanya Fields, she's a Bronx organizer, food justice organizer and farmer, and she got kicked off of the TED stage for talking about racism too overtly, so I kind of appreciate that about her. And so many others. These are just some organizations that are led by people of color that are doing the work of food justice and food sovereignty. So when we get into that kind of what can we do, we have to think about really following the lead of people who are directly impacted, right? So we're going to do a little call and response. I'm gonna have to look at the screen. So the way this works is I say, I have a shout, and then you all say out in unison. So a shout out is like giving props to someone, right? So I would say, I have a shout.
Out.
Good, but it's gonna be a little louder. Okay, so. I have a shout.
Out.
For the US Food Sovereignty Alliance. I have a shout.
Out.
For the National Black Food and Justice Alliance. I have a shout.
Out.
For SAFON. I have a shout.
Out.
For the Black Urban Growers, I have a shout.
Out.
For the Black Permaculture Network, I have a shout.
Out.
For the Black Farmers and Agriculturalists Association, I have a shout.
Out.
For the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, I have a shout.
Out.
For the Black Belt Justice Center, I have a shout.
Out.
For the Agricultural Justice Project, I have a shout.
Out.
For the Heal Food Alliance, I have a shout.
Out.
For this community, thank you very much for that. So the fourth thing we're doing out of 5 is working with our babies. And how many people here work with youth? You work with young people? So, so, so important. Because our young people are being given the message that the only thing they are good for is to consume. They need to consume media, they need to consume education, consume technology, and they're not ever reminded of the beautiful contributions that they already are making and have the potential to make. And this is especially true of Black and Brown youth. They don't not only get the consumer message, they get the message that the only future you have is to be imprisoned or to be shot. So why are you gonna think about the environment? Why are you gonna think about social justice? You just gotta try to survive to the next day. So when we created the Youth Food Justice Empowerment Program, it was to give the young people an experience that contradicted those messages. Yes, they learn to farm, they learn to cook, we love the same music that they do, we play on the trapeze, right? All of these things. But more than that, they have an opportunity to experience what it's like to truly be respected and to truly contribute, to grow food that goes back into their own community, to pick flowers and get to bring them home to their mom, to actually have input on policy that's gonna be championed by a certain grassroots group to try to reform the school-to-prison pipeline. Particularly, there's this one young man, Kareem, and we talk about the spiritual integrated with the justice. This young man, Kareem, came to our farm. He was a court-adjudicated youth, so he was in trouble with the law. And when he first got there, he did not want to interact with anyone. He had his hood up, he had his earbuds in, it was hard to get him out of the van. And that's all right. We didn't press him to like speak in the opening circle. He just passed. And then it was time to go on a tour of the farm, and he didn't want to get his sneakers dirty. And his friends didn't want to get their sneakers dirty because they had some nice kicks. And it was a muddy day. So we're like, oh, you can take your shoes off. And they were like, hell no, I take your shoes off. But then it was like, get your sneakers dirty, take your shoes off. They took their shoes off. And what Kareem experienced, and he later shared in our closing circle, was that as soon as his bare foot touched the warm, warm soil, he felt a memory of his grandmother come up his foot to his heart. She had passed away many years before, and when he was a little boy, she had gardens with him. And he hadn't remembered ever having a connection to the lands. And he started to cry in that closing circle. And I don't know if you worked, but these are some hard kids. Like, they don't cry in closing circle. And he's talking about his grandma and how she would put the soil or she would put a worm in his hand and teach him to not be afraid, and how he felt like he belonged in that moment to his history and also to the earth, and that he'd forgotten. and he needed his barefoot on the earth to remember. And then all the boys started talking about their grandmas, and then they made a movie about their grandmas. It was like the most beautiful thing ever. So the outcomes are not always clear to check off in some kind of grant report, because you can't check off remembering who you are in a grant report, but that is what the land can offer us. Many of the young people in our community are trapped in what's called the school-to-prison pipeline. Disciplinary issues in school lead to mass incarceration. That's the point of another lecture. But we actually worked out an arrangement with the Albany County DA that, from our perspective, the story's like this. The state is messing up with our children. Let us have them back. Our elders, the adults in our community, can mentor our children and help them be on track to the people that they are destined to become. The state should not have that responsibility. So we convinced the Albany County DA to do an alternative to incarceration program, where if young people came and trained with us for 50 hours and they graduated with good marks, their records would be wiped clean. They'd be out of the system, interrupting that downward cycle. They almost canceled the program the first year because one child made a mistake. He stole something. And they thought it was over, right? They had no conception of restoration, no conception of reform. The child stole a cell phone because he was hungry. And we worked with that child to do the necessary retribution, to come up with new contracts and to work through. And none of the people, the judges, the lawyers, had ever seen a true restorative process. So now we've expanded this program to many other community organizations who work with them. We've had 15 children graduate. This year we have another 15 coming through. The last thing we're working on is the Movement for Black Lives. So this started because my mentor and elder, Baba Curtis Muhammad, he came to our farm and he was telling me how the civil rights movement actually would not have happened without black farmers. He said, not metaphorically, like all those activists coming to the South, no hotel was gonna put them up, no restaurant was gonna feed them, no cobbler would fix their shoes, there was nowhere for them to meet. Black farmers put up their land and their space to host the activists. But not only that, because they could not get fired because they had their own job, they were not domestics or sharecroppers, they could be on the front of the line for voter registration. They could convene the meetings. So we said, what are you doing as a farmer for our movement, for civil rights? Because the Movement for Black Lives is the modern civil rights movement. And so we just started copying our ancestors. We're like, does anyone need a place to meet? You need some food? Come. So we've had now thousands of activists come and use our space as a safer space. Right now, and this is only word of mouth, we're not going to write it down, we have an above ground railroad. We are housing and hiding people who are being targeted for deportation. We do racial justice training, and we do organizing. We try to write policy suggestions for national organizations like Black Lives Matter, for the Farm Bill, for the National Black Land and Justice Association, and internationally collaborate with other farmers who are dealing with the same forces of corporate oppression, doing international solidarity work in Haiti and in Mexico and Ghana and Brazil. So that's us. And this is what we're going to do now. We're going to spend like 10 more minutes with our energy all focused together for some questions and conversation. I have a most beautiful poem that we're going to end with in about 10 minutes. And then after that, if you still have more energy, I'm going to hang around. Okay? All right, so this is how we're going to do this poem. We probably have to look this way so we can see. So we're each going to take like a little phrase or a line of the poem. And then when you're done, you just pass the mic to the next person until we read the whole thing. Okay? So I'll start. See what you can do.
Never mind. You can't tell one letter from another.
Never mind you born a slave. Never mind you lose your name. Never mind your daddy dead. Never mind nothing.
Here, this here is what a man can do if he puts his mind to it and is back in it.
Stop sniveling, the land said. Stop picking around the edges of the world. Take advantage, and if you can't, take disadvantage. We live here on this planet, in this nation, in this country, right here.
Nowhere else.
We got a home in this rock, don't you see?
Nobody's starving in my home. Nobody's crying in my home. And if I got a home, you got one too. Grab it. Grab this land.
Take it. Hold it, my brothers. Make it, my sisters. Shake it, squeeze it, turn it, twist it, beat it, kick it, kiss it. Whip it, stomp it, dig it, plow it, seed it, reap it, rent it, buy it, sell it, own it, build it, multiply it, and pass it on.
Can you hear me? Pass it on. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. If you want to continue the conversation, I'll be here for a little bit. Just come up and we can chat. Otherwise, I'll see y'all tomorrow.